champions of Montreal.
KUT 90.3 FM. It's May 19th, 2021 still, and it's just after 6 o'clock. You're listening to In the Motherhood for our May 19th show. We're a monthly show about parenting, specifically from a feminist point of view. On today's show, I'm going to feature two shows that are borrowed from fellow community radio programs here in Canada. The first is Wings, and that will be talking about maternal gift stories. So it's about featuring two well-known activists who came together to tell stories from their lives about the gift economy and survival value outside the world's economic calculus, which is an interesting point of view because the women are mothers too. And we know that there's a lot of material desires from children and parents too, and it's really pushed on us. There's a big part of the marketing world, as we know, that caters directly to mothers, fathers, parents, and children of all ages. And the second part of the show is about challenging anti-Black racism in the school system. And this is from Talking Radical Radio. They're talking to the group Parents of Black Children, who are supporting parents and advocating for Black students. They're in Hamilton, Ontario, and Toronto, Ontario. So thank you for listening to In the Motherhood. My name is Robin Fadden. You can email us at inthemotherhood@ckut.ca. You can find out more about us on Facebook. It's CKUT-InTheMotherhood on Facebook. Thanks for listening.
Today on Wings. Stories about the gift economy.
Actions that we do for our communities is what makes the rest of the world run and pretend that, you know, everything is for sale. But there is this whole hidden part that make it possible for anyone to sell anything.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
On April 24, 2021, two well-known activists came together online to tell stories about the gift economy, which is the source of value unrecognized in the world's economic calculus. Medea Benjamin is from the United States. She co-founded both the women-led peace group Code Pink and the human rights group Global Exchange. She has authored 10 books, among them Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control. Kumba Touré grew up in both Mali and Senegal. She belongs to the African Feminist Forum, chairs the board of Trust Africa, and co-coordinates Africans Rising for Justice, Peace, and Dignity. She's an artist and storyteller and designs popular education programs. Kumba and Medea have known each other for a long time. Both are now mothers. The event at which they spoke is from the series Maternal Gift Economy Breaking Through. Here are some of their stories.
Gift economy is something that I've experienced all my life. I've received so much and from so many. I remember coming to the U.S. In 1997 in San Francisco as a young person doing an internship at Global Exchange. And Medea Benjamin here and her family got their daughter out of her room and gave me, you know, the young daughter. Of course, she was happy to to go with her parents at that time, but just the symbolism of this. And I stayed there. For free. This young woman from Senegal that, you know, you have only, I guess, philosophical connection with to be able to make that gift of hosting, and did my internship, and it's something that changed and transformed my life. And Medea is exceptional, of course, we know that. But I also want to say that it is not an exception in the activist community. Right before that, the year before, was my first trip to the US, 1996. We came from Mali, and it was 22 of us on a study tour on African identity, and we wanted to know about the life of African outside of Africa, African diasporas. And we went to Selma, Alabama. And the moment we landed in Atlanta, we were welcomed by communities and people all the way, Georgia, Alabama, North and South Carolina, Louisiana, Tennessee, Mississippi. 22 of us, the only money that we had that was the Institute for Popular Education was really our tickets to get to the US at that time. And we were cared for. You know, this is extraordinary, you know, and it happens all the time. And it goes unsaid. It's in nobody's report or proposal or anything. If I don't tell you this story, nobody will ever know that people gave us their food, churches cooked for us, university students, everything, as we went on these studies. And I wanted to make them visible and important. I say this because sometimes when you think about gift economy, we go back to the traditional societies and communities and how people used to live before in I don't know how many hundreds of years, but the reality is that it is a very, very alive practice. If we just take time to notice how people do it and start computing every day what we do and what we give for free and how it makes the whole world actually move, because that's what we do.
I'm so glad you talk about the US in those terms, because I was thinking this morning how materialist the US society is in general, and that my mother, who passed away many years ago and I love dearly, but she had a very materialist view of the world. And I remember one time, and this is many decades ago, before we had heard of the guy who was last in the White House, me asking her who she looked up to the most in the world. And she said Donald Trump, because she was a New Yorker, and he was a New Yorker who had made lots of money and was very supposedly a successful businessman. And that's who was her role model. And I, at the time, had started reading some, I was in high school then, some more revolutionary books. And I said, my role model was Che Guevara. And as I got older and ended up living in Cuba, on my way to work, I would go by a bicycle and particularly go out of my way to go by a hospital that had a big sign on it with a quote from Che Guevara that said, "The life of one child is worth more than the wealth of the richest person on earth." Mm. And I thought that was so beautiful that I wanted to see it every day as I made my way to the office where I was working. So I'm glad, Kumba, that you remind me and us that there is this beautiful gift economy that is everywhere in the world. Sometimes you have to go out of your society to see it. And part of the reason for creating Global Exchange was to have people-to-people exchanges, have people like you, Kumba, come to the U.S. and people from the U.S. go outside of their bubble and see other parts of the world. And the first place we went was Haiti and the Dominican Republic. There are two stories I'll try to quickly tell. One was when we went to the Dominican Republic, we went to a small agricultural community, and they took us around and showed us their farms. And then in about 5 o'clock, we met in the community center, and they said, every Friday evening, we get together in what we call happy hour. And I'm thinking happy hour in the US, where you just, drink and have conversations. And we said, great. So we went in there, and the happy hour for them is that one by one, they would go around and each person would perform something that they had done themselves. So a poem they had written, a song they had made up, a tune on the guitar they wanted to share, some dance moves that they came up with, a joke that they came up with, anything that was might be entertaining to others, but showed their personal creativity. And they went around and each one had a beautiful thing to share. And then they turned to our group and they said to us, now it's your time. If you could go one by one and share something with us. And we all went like, oh, what is that? And we had to huddle and try to help each other come up with something. And what we realized is how our culture was so commercial, and that the songs we knew were ones we heard on the radio, or the poems we, if we barely remembered them, were other people's poems, that we just didn't have that kind of creativity. And it was very embarrassing for us, but it made us all afterwards come together and really think about how we share, how we give to each other things that have no monetary value, but come from deep inside. And the other story I wanted to give was from that same trip where we were in Haiti, and you know, a very poor country. And you know, Kevin, who I was married to at the time, and I got up early one morning before the group had any activities, and we went out and started walking. And two young Haitian boys started beckoning us to come with them. And so we started walking with them, and we were going up and up and up a hill. And we're thinking, oh my God, where are they taking us? We don't have enough time. We start to get a little scared, and we're going up and up and up and up. And finally, we get up to the top of the hill, and it's just as the sun is rising. And it's this gorgeous view, this spiritual moment with the sun rising. And the boys were just there to smile and have us appreciate the beauty of the place where they lived. And so those are two examples that have stayed with many of us from that very first trip that show that you can give people things without monetary value on them, and that so much of life is about sharing what we love and what we can create or show as creations of nature.
Mm, thank you. Thank you so much, Medea, for sharing these stories.
On Wings, you're listening to Kumba Touré and Medea Benjamin. Kumba is speaking from Senegal and Medea from the United States. Their dialogue is part of a series of online events titled Maternal Gift Economy Breaking Through. The maternal gift economy, a term created by Genevieve Vaughn, is comprised of the free gifts of people and nature that are immeasurable in money and essential to life. The stories in this program are from a 2-hour dialogue, free to watch, at maternalgifteconomymovement.org.
Gifts are in so many forms. I personally believe that, you know, some of the most precious gift really is the gift of time, the gift of presence in the communities where I've lived and where I'm from. That is what people have. Like when people are sad, when they're mourning, or when they're happy, what people do is be there, be present. If you have a party or a wedding or a baptism, something, people rarely comment about what the place was or what the food was like. Just, it was so great. There were so many people. Just the presence of people is the value of it. How many people spend time and sit and be there with you and give what they have the most precious, which is the time of our life that is basically limited. So the neighbors, if they hear the music, of course they'll come and dance and give their little part of whatever they can and go. And of course, there is a judgment about it in a modern, you want to call it in a modern society. Things are changing so fast in big cities. People want to show how much they have and how much they can accumulate. But the way someone is valued is how many links and diverse connection can they maintain. And that's how you say a person is a good person. Oh, this person is connected to many people because they will greet people on the street, they will go and see people when they are sick, etc. Those are small things, but people see the value. I just tell one story where I had a friend who came to visit in Mali, and she was from the US. And at the time, I believe she had picked up malaria or something. But when someone is not doing well, when you're feeling sick or depressed or you have some issues, that is the time people choose to actually be there and surround you. Like, they won't leave you alone, basically. It's very difficult to be left alone. And we didn't know that from where she came from, if you're not doing well, you basically want to hide until you get better, and then you are with people. So it was like the complete opposite. It was a very crazy situation where she would kind of move and go somewhere to isolate herself, and all of a sudden, the room would be full with people and children and everybody. And even if it's uncomfortable, people are just like, yeah, we are here. It's okay. You're sick or you're in pain, and everybody goes through it. And well, that's part of that gift of presence that I wanted to really underline and say that it's something that I cherish.
It must be particularly hard during COVID for societies that are used to being communal to isolate people or to isolate yourself if you are sick and have a disease that can be passed on.
It's the most difficult. People have been speaking to this so much because a transmittable disease goes basically against the way people know to care. So what do you do? How do people even go through mourning? Because you're going to be sad and you know that there is a loss. But before, we all recognize together that this is part of life. Now, how do people go through mourning without the witnessing and you know, the touching, the holding each other and the being together? I think it's been the most difficult part of the COVID-19 for people here.
Back a little to this issue of the giving of time and the sharing of tasks. Could you talk a little bit about being a mother and how this gift economy comes into play in the day-to-day work of mothering?
Yes, Medea, you've gone through this before me, so you can tell me your share about it too. And you know, I knew intellectually, and we always had this conversation about gift economy with Jen, you know, the maternal roots of it and how we learn about it and where it starts. And intellectually, of course, we knew it. But you practice it as a mother. You practice it as a person who cares for community. And we practice it as an activist, because to me, it's just different gradient of what we give and how we give. We realize that there is so much that we do as a gift for free. It is time, it is energy, it is thinking, it is design, it is imagination, it is everything that you could ever think about to make sure that somebody not only survives, but also thrives. And we learn things as we do it for little children. That is also what we try to do with our own communities, to try to make change happen. So there is no more counting of hours or anything. You just give and you just do what is needed. And of course, it is, you know, and we recognize again that the pillars on which actually the whole world stands is free work, mainly from women, but also from anybody who's like you know, care workers, of course, COVID-19 helped us understand that, whether you take care of children, of elderly, or people who are sick or with disability, all of those actions that we do for our communities is what makes the rest of the world run and pretend that, you know, everything is for sale. But there is this whole hidden part that make it possible for anyone to sell anything.
That brings up to me a dilemma that I wanted to ask you about and how you deal with it in your activism, which is, in my years of doing work around social justice issues, there have been times where there is a conflict between doing this, it's hard to even say work, I mean, it's passion around helping the community, social justice, caring for the world, trying to stop war, loving the earth, and the dilemma that people have to earn income. And then you have what's often called the NGOization, the nonprofit world that has come to create job opportunities for people, but also then has a negative side in which sometimes it becomes a job more than a passion. So at, you know, 5 o'clock, your work is done and doesn't allow for enough involvement of the community. And some would say that it saps, it takes the most passionate activists and turns them into workers for an organization rather than community leaders that are organizing more naturally in the community. So I wonder how, in your years of doing this work, if you've come across that as well, or is that more something that really affects us in wealthier countries where there are more of these NGOs?
Yes, I come across it, and also we struggle with it. There is a dilemma, but I'll make the parallel with, for example, of course, we do all this care work for the children, for the house and everything. And of course, nobody pays for it. And you start thinking, if we were to fight for it to be recognized and for people to be paid for it, what would it do? Would we do it with the same passion, or would we start thinking, okay, you know, this is a job? And yes, there are people who do care work as a job, but they're still care workers and they're still giving that care. Because even when you are paid for it, there is a part of it that's just unpayable. That's the only word I could find. It doesn't matter how much somebody gives you, that care, that tenderness, that look, and the way you do this thing cannot be paid for. There is a part of it that comes only from you. I mean, except if they're going to make some robots to do them now. And I'll do that parallel also with the work of activism. Most people do it by passion and do it for free or for much less than what they could have made if they were somewhere else. And the truth is, if you are passionate about caring for the earth, as much as, you know, somebody can pay you, there is a part of it that is still your gift. And that gift is the choice you make to care. I think the choice we make to care is that part that is, you know, profoundly human. And of course, as soon as, you know, money comes in and certain structures come in, you have all kinds of things happening in all kinds of fields. And I am among maybe the one who, you know, I would say, yes, you know, if I could pay women for the work that they're doing in their house, taking care of their baby, I would do it, their own baby, because they give birth to these kids and they take care of them for the whole world to benefit from. And nobody's ever, you know, looking at that. And if I can pay activists to do something that they would do for free, I'll pay them to do it also. But I know that there is a dilemma, and I know that there is a struggle there. But always we need to go back and recognize that paying doesn't do it and cannot make it happen. You know, you can't just put your money on the plate and eat it. You know, somebody need to pull that food together. and if they don't, the money doesn't transform itself into food.
Talking about caregiving, I had my first child when I was in Cuba, which is a society where people love children and they're always helping each other, looking out for each other. And I remember that from the time my child was born, the neighbors would be always coming in and taking her.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't think about, where is she? Is she being fed? Is she being cared for? What time are they bringing her back? It was just, you knew that there was just love in the community, and your child, like all the children, were well cared for. And then when I moved back to the US and had my second child here, I was alone and I couldn't believe it. I was like, where is everybody? Where is the community? And it's suddenly like this child was a burden to other people. I mean, not always, but in some spaces. Yes. It would not be great if the child was crying during an event.
Yes.
Nobody would come over and grab the child and help you with it. They would be like looking at you like, don't you want to take that child out of here?
No, but dear, I like that you know, example, because I did see that at least in our communities and some of our houses, when you have a child, your own child, you know, that you gave birth to, you have to look for your child to get your kid, because the moment somebody see you with a child and like, oh, is this your child? And you say yes, they pick it from you, because the reasoning behind it is that it doesn't matter how much people help you and take the child, you'll remain with something to do for that child, because there will be a point where, well, you know, the child has to go, you know, if you're breastfeeding, you're the only one to do it. If they're sleeping with you, if they're sick and you have to take, I mean, they know that it doesn't matter. People can pick the child as much as they want. There will be enough to do for you. So that's the first instinct, is to first relieve the mother and make sure that you give a little time and a little share, because you know that there will be some more to do. And when I came to the US, you know, with my children, I was just like, how do people do this here? Let me just tell you one thing. This doesn't make sense. Nobody can take care of a child by themselves. And they're like, yes, 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 we do. I'm like, who? But the truth is, I looked at myself, I'm just like, how do women do this?
Imagine during COVID when your children are at home and you're supposed to be taking care of them and doing your work. In societies like these, where we're so compartmentalized and don't live in extended families for the most part.
That's why I talk about gift economy as a political practice, because in many ways, I would do it in a very unconscious way. It's just like, oh, that's how, what you do, and that's how life is. Or I benefited it without even knowing that it was there or important, because it's just there. Everybody does it. So how do you know? It's only as you grow up, I guess, you learn, you read, and you travel. You're just like, oh, wait a minute, not everybody does this. And, you know, we're losing this when we are in the cities, or when you are in certain setting, it doesn't happen anymore. And then you see like the value of this gift economy, how it helps people stay sane, because I know a lot of people would be gone completely mad if there was not this circular gift economy way.
Those were some of the stories told by Kumba Touré and Madea Benjamin when they joined the online series Maternal Gift Economy Breaking Through in April 2021. You can find the video of their entire discussion and the rest of this ongoing series at the website maternalgifteconomymovement.org. That's all one word, maternalgifteconomymovement.org. To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org or visit our website, wingsradio.org/wordpress. Wings thanks our supporters, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen and Genevieve Vaughn, whose books include The Maternal Roots of the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. I'm Wings series producer Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
And that was a talk about maternal gift stories, about mothering, activism, and care, borrowed from Wings. Thank you to Wings for letting us borrow that piece. And coming up next, we have a show about challenging anti-Black racism in the school system, talking with the group Parents of Black Children in Hamilton and Toronto, Ontario.
My name is Scott Nye, and this is Talking Radical Radio. Hello, and welcome to Talking Radical Radio, where we bring you grassroots voices from across Canada. We give you the chance to hear many different people who are facing many different struggles talk about what they're doing, how they're doing it, and why they're doing it, in the belief that such listening is a crucial step in strengthening all of our efforts to change the world. On this week's show, I'll be speaking with Carrie Daniel. When Carrie Daniel's son was 7 years old, she started getting calls home from his teacher on a regular basis. He'd never had any behavioral issues before, but now it seemed there were many. At first, she took this at face value and responded accordingly. But as she continued to get calls from this teacher, it became clear that something else was going on. Daniel said, quote, "He couldn't breathe in the class without this teacher picking up the phone to complain," end quote. This was, in fact, a pretty classic example of one of the ways in which anti-Black racism shows up in the school system. Black kids at around that age often begin to be subjected to excessive surveillance and policing, analogous to what Black people in Canada face more generally. In the context of schools, this can look like heightened scrutiny from teachers, like getting in trouble for behaviors that are ignored or dealt with in a non-disciplinary way when exhibited by their peers, like harsher punishments, and like being tagged as quote-unquote a problem. This takes a major emotional toll on Black children and youth. There are many other ways that anti-Blackness shows up in schools as well. This includes inadequate responses to racist microaggressions and bullying. It includes Black youth being disproportionately streamed into non-academic or low-achievement programs. Only 54% of Black students said they felt supported by teachers in a 2006 census survey. Black and other racialized people are significantly underrepresented as teachers. And consistently, students face curriculum and teaching practices that erase or denigrate Black histories and present-day realities. Daniel, of course, has had her own lifetime of experience of anti-Black racism in school and elsewhere. But she said that in some ways, she really became politicized around becoming a mother, and her children's experiences really set the stage for her involvement in advocacy work related to anti-Black racism in the education system. Her kids were in the York Catholic District School Board, just north of Toronto, so that was the initial focus of her efforts. There were also a handful of Black parents and teachers doing similar things with the public school board in that area. After a public meeting drew all of them and many other Black parents together, Daniel and a small group of others decided to start an organization to collectivize their efforts, which they called Parents of Black Children. In the summer of 2020, as racial justice protests were erupting across the continent and as the first wave of the COVID-19 pandemic began to recede, the group held a march specifically for Black students in Toronto. They formulated 10 demands for the Ontario Ministry of Education, including decolonized curriculum, police-free schools province-wide, collection of disaggregated race-based data, equity audits of all school boards in the province, and more. They've also been very involved in providing direct support to other parents. Because of how the pandemic has moved activities of all sorts online, they've been able to do this not just for parents in the Toronto area, but across Ontario. They have system navigators for supporting parents in relation to both the school and child welfare systems, which can include everything from accompaniment at meetings with officials to assistance in filing human rights complaints. They also offer workshops to help Black parents learn more about the systems they have to deal with. Recently, they launched an online reporting tool for educators to submit information about incidents of anti-Black racism that they experience or witness in Canadian schools. This is a tool for data collection and unfortunately cannot lead to action in the specific cases that are reported, but it is a way to begin building a much richer picture of how anti-Black racism shows up in schools and using that as the basis for advocacy demanding systemic changes. Daniel couldn't really say whether or not last year's uprising had shifted how schools, boards, and the ministry are responding to anti-Black racism. But she did say, quote, "For us, this is a crisis," end quote. While from institutions with the power to make change, quote, "there's no response with real urgency," end quote. Along with continuing their direct support for Black parents and youth, Parents of Black Children is considering starting chapters in local areas to focus on advocacy at individual school boards. And they'll be continuing to put pressure at the ministry level for broader systemic changes. I speak with Daniel about anti-Black racism in the school system and about the work of Parents of Black Children.
My name is Carrie Daniel. I'm a mom of two. I live in the Greater Toronto area. I have a blog and podcast as well called Woke Mommy Chatter. And my background is communications and public relations work, and I do equity consulting. And our group, Parents of Black Children, is an advocacy group that was formed to really address the systemic issues of anti-Black racism and this disparity in education and also outcomes for Black kids in the education system. So we advocate on behalf of Black parents, we support Black parents, and we provide resources to help Black parents build their knowledge in terms of the education system. I've always been socially conscious and socially aware. I grew up in Jane and Finch, which in Toronto they refer to as a high priority neighborhood, meaning that there were a lot of immigrants and poor people and racialized people who lived in the community. And growing up in a community like that, which was a wonderful community from my perspective, but it really opens your eyes in terms of relationships with police, the ideas that people have and stereotypes that people may have about, you know, where you live. So social justice and advocacy and the needs of particular groups of people and communities has always been something that's been really close to me. When I became a parent, I think, you know, being a Black mother, it's political. I have a son and I have a daughter. And the honest truth is when my husband and I found out we were having a boy, we were scared. We love our children more than anything and we love our son, but we were frightened because of what that meant to bring a Black boy into this world. And we knew that there would be particular implications for what that meant about his experience and his safety. And I was really conscious about that in terms of his educational experience as well, because I know what my experience was. So parenthood really opened my eyes more so than anything. When my son was about 4 or 5, we're driving in the car and he kept saying, he's like, "Blackie, Blackie, Blackie." And I thought he was saying lackey, like someone who kind of, you know, follows someone around. And I thought, wow, my child has a great, great vocabulary. So I turned to him and I said, "Where'd you hear that word lackey?" And he said, "I'm not saying lackey, I'm saying blackie." And then he kept saying it. So I pulled the car over and I turned to him and I said, who told you that? And he said, "My friend said it's another word for Black people." So, you know, I talked to him about why you don't use that word. But I also recognized that we needed support. Like, it just wasn't enough for us to have our family. And he needed to be surrounded by friends and people that looked like him, too. And I think that moment is probably one of the moments that really kind of drove me and got me involved, particularly in examining this idea of Black motherhood that later led to Parents of Black Children. Parents of Black Children came together organically. My kids are in the York Catholic School Board system, and we had another person, her name is Charlene Grant, and her kids were in York Public. At the same time, there were teachers within York Public, Black teachers, who were organizing and coming together. And I was pushing in my board for equity and anti-Black racism initiatives and part of the equity committee at that board and really pushing them to examine the experience of Black children and the Black families in their board. And so all of us were working, doing this work kind of on our own. And then Claudette, who is a teacher who works in the York Public Board, called a meeting. And it was initially just York Public. I heard about it, called everyone I knew, including Charlene. And there were over 100 Black parents in the room. And out of that, a few of us came together and decided to start an organization. And at first, the organization was really just for York Region. It was just so we could collectivize so that I wasn't fighting alone in the York Catholic Board and they weren't fighting alone in the York Public, that we would come together. But what happened is once we formed this organization and people heard about it, they came to us for support from Thunder Bay in Ontario, like the top of Ontario, right down to the bottom in Windsor. We've grown so quickly. We have over 2,000 people that we reach every month via our email newsletter. We are nationally incorporated now. We have people calling us from Calgary and Quebec and Nova Scotia wanting to start chapters. So it's grown more than we could have imagined. And it started out as a group of moms really coming together to advocate and work on behalf of our kids. And it's just ballooned into something bigger because people need support, Black families. It doesn't matter your socioeconomic status, and it doesn't matter where you live, what province, what country. The experience of our kids in the education system is the same, and it is heavy, is how I describe it.
So what do Black children and youth face in the school system?
We've gotten calls from everywhere, and it's the same stories. In my case, my son was only 7 at the time. The teacher would call me consistently about everything he did. And this is a child that we never had issues with before, and we really haven't had issues with since this time. But he couldn't do anything. He couldn't. He told a story in class, and she called me because she thought he needed to go to a psychiatrist because she didn't like the story. There was a bunny in the story, and the bunny died, and we needed to talk about that. And then he had scissors in his hands, and it was art class, and she said he was a danger to himself and others. He would, you know, stand in line, and she'd say that he's moving too much in line. He has to stand straight. And he was only 7. Like, think about that. He's 7. He couldn't breathe in the class without her picking up the phone to complain or to call me or to problematize something, anything that he was doing. And it affected him emotionally. He began to be really anxious. He didn't want to go to school in the morning. He couldn't sleep. We had to get him a weighted blanket to ease his anxiety. They're microaggressions, but they're actually not micro. They're not as obvious. So for a parent seeing that, you may not necessarily recognize that as anti-Black racism, right? And for us, at first, we kept saying to him, like, why aren't you standing still? What's wrong? Why can't you behave? Like, what's going on? Putting all that pressure and blame on the child. And it wasn't until I'd read a report by Carl James, and exactly what we were going through was identified in this report as the way in which Black children at around this age are problematized, and that being a reason why they disengage. So Black children statistically are more likely to disengage from school as young as 8 years old. It's that age, right, where they're growing up, they're beginning to be seen as a little bit of a threat, and they're targeted. We see a lot of that. We see a lot of Black kids being streamed and being put on independent education plans, Black kids being pushed into specialized programming or streamed out of specialized programming, like French immersion, for example. Suspensions are much higher for Black children, whereas they may not do that with another child. They suspend with a Black child. So these are the things that we see consistently. And it just doesn't matter if it's York or Peel or Durham. Anywhere, it's the same. It's the same thing.
And you mentioned earlier some of your specific concerns around having a son and the gendered impacts of anti-Black racism. How does that play out in the school system in terms of different impacts on boys and girls?
Parents of Black children, we collect our own data. We have a systems navigator who is an advocate and will stand beside parents. So any parent that has a problem can go to our website, fill out the intake form, tell us what the issue is, and we will support. We'll go to meetings with them, write letters on their behalf. We'll connect them with Black educators if they want to run something by a teacher that isn't their own child's teacher. We connect them with legal supports. We'll help them if they want to file a human rights claim. We'll do all of those things to support them. And are we seeing a gender difference? Not really. And what we know is this data tells us that for Black boys, they're most impacted by the racism because they are seen as threats within the schools, particularly as they get older. But we're seeing it with our girls too. So I don't know if there's a real gender difference. I think that generally for Black boys, because people identify the threat as a little bit different, it's harder for them. But I wouldn't say that because you have a Black girl that you're not going to experience the same thing. It might look a little bit different. Like our girls are called sassy, you know, they're told they have an attitude problem, or people check them in a different way than our boys. It's interesting because of popular culture, often Black boys will come with a lot of social capital in high school, which is interesting, but exposes them as well in a different way.
In the face of all of these barriers, what are some of the things that your group has been doing?
We do a lot of advocacy. So at the beginning of the summer, just as the pandemic had kind of eased a little bit, we held a march, and it was the first march in Toronto for Black students ever. And it was great because we had people from all over come. There were hundreds of people there. And as part of that march, we formed 10 demands that we sent to the Ministry of Education. Those demands ranged from reforming the Education Act, decolonizing the curriculum, right down to collecting desegregated race-based data, equity audits in schools. Those are also on our website. So we've pushed for those demands, and I'm happy to say that some of them have changed. One of them was around accountability for teachers who are perpetuating racism and discrimination in their classrooms. And what we've seen over the last few months is the ministry come out with an announcement to say that the Ontario College of Teachers is now going to categorize racism and discrimination as a professional misconduct. And that's a huge win. There's still a lot of gray. Like, we need to understand what that professional misconduct means. But what that does is that anyone who can experience any form of discrimination or racism now has an avenue to report that teacher and for there to be accountability for the teacher in question. The other thing we do, as I talked about, was the systems navigation. So we do that for both education and child welfare. Parents fill out these forms for anything. Whatever it is, we come in and provide that support and add an extra layer of support for families. And we do the same thing in the child welfare space because we know our kids are funneled from education to criminal justice to child welfare. And so we do the same thing in that space. And then we also do workshops. We have a series of workshops that are led by our education team, and our education team are all teachers, Ontario certified teachers. And I always say, like, teachers speak a whole other language. And there are so many processes in schools that parents don't know. So, you know, I'm pretty involved in my child's education, but there are things I learned that I didn't know. You know, the fact that there's a document called Growing Success, which means that if your child doesn't test well, like they don't do well on tests, you can ask your teacher to give them an alternative method of evaluation, right? You can challenge the grades on your child's report cards, and the grades can be changed. They're not final just because they come on a report card. So things like that are the knowledge building pieces that we're giving to parents. And then we just launched an anti-Black racism reporting tool. What was happening was we were getting a lot of educators, many of them Black, but many of them not, who were saying to us, I'm speaking up for Black kids in my school, and I'm getting a letter in my file. My principal is saying that I'm a troublemaker. I'm not getting the advancements that I want to make, and I'm feeling like I'm being targeted because I'm speaking up. And they didn't have any place to take that because they didn't feel safe reporting it through their board or their union. So we've launched the anti-Black racism reporting tool where anyone who's working in the education space can anonymously report any instance of anti-Black racism that they see or that impacts them directly. The reason this is important is because it gives us the first visibility into what's happening for people who are working on boards across the province. We don't have that currently. We launched maybe about a week and a bit ago, and we have coming up to about 110 responses so far. And we're going to be looking at the data as it comes in and reporting back quarterly publicly on what we're finding.
Let's talk in a little more detail about a couple of your demands. Why, for instance, is it important to make changes in curriculum, and what would those changes look like?
Someone said to me today, actually, she's a teacher, and she said, you know, when I'm teaching, I always say to my class that if I'm teaching them something and I'm looking at the curriculum and I'm looking at the textbook and it's the same information that I learned 30 years ago, that's a problem. And she's right. When we talk about decolonizing the curriculum, it's really looking at including experiences that are not centered in a Eurocentric lens. Everything in our schools centers whiteness, everything. Whether it is the Band-Aid that the office keeps when a child hurts themselves, right through to, we could talk about history books, but also even math or science, or, you know, if your kids are in a Catholic school, religion, like just everything centers whiteness. And so part of decolonizing the curriculum is looking at the experiences of Indigenous communities and telling the story from their lens. Looking at the experiences of Black communities and telling the story from our lens. That's a really critical piece. It's important because kids need to see themselves, plain and simple. It's good for all kids, not just Black kids, not just Indigenous kids. It's good for all kids.
And another of your demands is to have the police-free schools that certain boards have implemented extended across the province. Why is that an important change?
What the data tells us is that at schools that have school resource officers or school engagement team, the interaction between police and Black students in those schools is much higher. Black students report that they don't feel safe going to schools with police. The other thing that we know that happens too is police, they're not just there to be friendly. Like, we know that they are also there observing, they're making observations, they're reporting that, and our kids are targets when that's the case. So there really is no reason for police to be in schools. I think that at one time it was believed that having police in schools would bridge the relationships and bridge the gap between community and police. That was, you know, in the 80s, 90s, maybe. We know now, there's been a lot of research, we know differently. And when you know better, you do better, right? And that's what we're asking. We've seen the research. It's telling us that police in schools actually is not a good thing for Black and racialized kids. So let's get them out. There's no reason for them to be there.
What have you been doing since that initial march that you mentioned to advance your demands with boards and with the province?
One of the things that we realized really quickly when we formed as a group was that we can't take this fight to every board. So we will support parents when they come to us and we will fight for parents. But expecting boards to do the right thing isn't going to happen. So we really focus our energies and our advocacy at the province. We have been meeting, like we were meeting with the anti-racism critic at the time. We write a lot of letters. And we get our allies. We have a great group of allies. So we have a lot of people who are not Black and who are not even parents, but who recognize the urgency and the crisis, and who, when we post a campaign on something, will write letters on our behalf and will inundate a board or the Ministry of Education with letters to the point that they can't ignore us. Socio-emotional learning is a good example of that. The ministry was rolling out a curriculum for math that was anchored in socio-emotional learning, SEL. And what they say is that it takes into account how children feel about learning math and takes into account their emotional state in terms of learning something. And it kind of meets them where they're at. What we know is that socio-emotional learning, the history of it is anchored in eugenics, and like residential schools kind of come out of that methodology as well. And so we pushed for the ministry to stop rolling it out. They didn't stop completely, they paused, but that pause was because they were inundated with letters from allies and from parents who were concerned. I think our next push is to work with them to get them to understand that it's hard to roll a curriculum like that out if educators are not practicing from an anti-racist lens, because what it means is you're asking educators to police children's emotions. And we know that when there are, you know, white people who are policing the emotions of Black kids, it's not positive. So we've been doing a lot of campaigns and a lot of letter writing and a lot of resistance in that way and trying to drive change.
In the course of all of these things that you're doing, do you have the sense that the responses that you're getting from these organizations on questions of anti-Black racism are any different today than they would have been before the uprising that happened last spring and summer?
I think that's a hard question to answer. I think what I would say is my expectation is that the response would be more urgent. But what we're seeing is that it's not. For us, this is a crisis. It was a crisis before the pandemic. It was a crisis before the murder of George Floyd. But what the murder of George Floyd did and what that upswell of protests and recognition did is it shone a light on what we already knew. And it's horrible and disgusting that it took a man's death, another death, for that to happen. But it shone a light. And I would say the difference is that I think the conversation around how to support those who are doing the work, so funding for those who are doing the work, is a little bit different and probably a little bit more accessible than it would have been prior. But to me, there's no response with the real urgency. Like when we see the response to the pandemic, where systems bent and shifted and changed and did full 360s overnight to respond to the pandemic, which they needed to do. What we say is we're in a pandemic too. This is like there's a racial pandemic. And so we need that response. And that's not the response we're getting.
So for your group, what is the importance, but also what are the challenges of working with anti-racist teachers and other allies on the inside of the education system?
It's important because we send our kids into the system unprotected. When you talk to teachers, they use language like, oh, you know, we love our kids, we work so hard, and all those things are true. But what we know is that often that love doesn't extend to Black kids. So teachers will put themselves in front of white children or even kids of other races to almost protect them, like a barrier from harm. But they won't do that for Black children. And often the reason they're not doing it is not because they don't want to. And this applies to Black teachers, right? They don't feel like they can do it in the same way because they feel like there'll be repercussions for them. So how can we as Black parents send our kids into a system where teachers are telling us, even Black teachers are saying, I don't feel I can speak up about the harm I see being caused to Black kids or Black students because I'm going to be harmed, because I'm not going to get a promotion. I might lose my job and my family needs to eat. So that's the importance of the tool, is that it sheds a light on what we know. This tool gives them some space to share their experiences and sheds some light on what's happening in the system so we can talk about it. Because, you know, when I say it out loud, I'm like, how can I send my kids into the education system knowing that there literally is no one there looking out for them?
What does parents of Black children have planned for the next while?
One of the main priorities is the analytics and the data that's coming in from this racism reporting tool. The response to this tool has been more than we could have imagined. So we're looking at partnering with a researcher to go through and start to pull the data so that at the end of the first quarter, we can do a report back. We're also looking at how we can address some of the deficiencies in terms of accountability at the boards and in terms of the illicit demands, like where we need to push at the provincial level. And then the third thing is, like I said, we get a lot of people reaching out to us. So we're looking at also building action committees for each region that can actually engage with their school boards and organizing people in that way so that we're all kind of saying the same thing. And there's a local connection on the ground trying to do this work as well.
You have been listening to my interview with Carrie Daniel of the group Parents of Black Children. To learn more about them, go to parentsofblackchildren.org. To find out more about Talking Radical Radio, the guests, the theme music, and the ways that you can listen, go to talkingradical.ca and click on the link for the radio show. On the site, you can sign up for email updates or follow us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, SoundCloud, and other platforms. I'm Scott Nye, a writer and media producer based in Hamilton, Ontario, and the author of two books of Canadian history told through the stories of activists published by Fernwood Publishing. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you tune in again next week.
And that was a talk with the group Parents of Black Children, Karen Daniel from Parents of Black Children, a group based in Hamilton and Toronto, Ontario. and they're talking about challenging anti-Black racism in the school system. A personal story, political story, and one that affects many people here in Canada. So you are listening to CKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Robin Fadden, and this is In the Motherhood. You can find out more about us on our Facebook page, CKUT-In the Motherhood, and you can email us at inthemotherhood@ckut.ca. So that's it for this month on May 19th, but we'll be back next month, the middle of June. We're the third Wednesday of the month. Thank you for listening to CKUT, and we'll see you then.
Okay, I gotta let you go. I have to get my Lake Magog vaccine.
Your Lake Magog vaccine?
Yeah, you know, I'm really looking forward to having the whole family to the cottage for my annual cookout.
Smart move. I'm gonna ask for the Montreal vaccine. I miss those last-minute get-togethers with my buddies.
Nice. Well, I gotta run. I don't think it protects against lateness.
Each vaccination brings us closer to...
Good evening and welcome to Amanda, 1 hour of African current affairs brought to you in English and sometimes French here on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal, CKUT.ca around the world. So I am sitting virtually with Doug Miller, and Doug, you were responsible for the whole lineup tonight, so take it away.
Well, I think with all due justice, we were all very indignant and unhappy with what we see going on in Palestine, Israel right now. Mm-hmm. It's disturbing that it continues to be like this. We've dealt with the issue of Israeli apartheid. Drew, you and I were part of a panel with the Independent Jewish Voices, yeah. Mm-hmm. About the B'Tselem declaration that Israel was a racist state, an apartheid state. When this recent stuff started, it was so upsetting that I got together with Dennis Kosem, who was the other panelist with us in the International Jewish Voices, Independent Jewish Voices panel, to explain his view of what was going on. And so he gives us a good background on it, as a good pedagogical pedagogue would. And then I talked with Aaron Lakoff, an old friend of ours from Amandla, from CKUT, and now himself the media and communications coordinator for